Will we have time for a question and answer session now? So, if you provide the questions, I'll do my best to provide the answers.
Yes.
Master Yates, I think we're blessed with having some new folks with us today. So,
yeah.
Could you perhaps talk about the equanimity meditation that we did and the origins of it?
Sure. Well, it's what's usually referred to as a loving kindness meditation. But as you can see, what we're really doing is rediscovering compassion, developing our capacity for compassion. The feelings that you are asked to raise, they serve you very well. It's amazing how easily people forget what it's like to be at ease and to be at peace. You know, so it's good to remind yourself. This particular practice, we recommend to include it as a part of your regular practice with whatever frequency seems appropriate to you. And one thing about, if you notice the order that I went through this, first, you bring the feelings up, which you can do even if you don't like yourself. You can bring the feelings up, and you have to do that. That's the first step. And then you start with somebody that's dear to you and close. And you practice sending these feelings and the wish for these feelings and the wish for this happiness to people, to the easiest ones, and then the not quite so easy, and then the most difficult ones. You save the most difficult one of all for last. Yourself. Because it is just, it's so common for all of us, in spite of all of our self-cherishing, even while we're self-cherishing, as a matter of fact, even at the root of much of our self-cherishing, is the sense that somehow there's something wrong with me. You know, I'm flawed. I don't deserve this. And a lot of our self-cherishing is just in compensation for that. Just because deep down in our heart we feel like we're not such a good person and we don't deserve happiness and all that sort of thing. And so you save yourself for last in this process. But this is a very powerful practice. It changes the way your mind works. What's that? The origins? Well, the precise origins of the practice, the way I do it, I know who it came from, but I don't know its longer history. It came from Upasaka Kemananda, which was my first Buddhist teacher. And it is a variation on the classical Theravadin loving-kindness meditation. There's several versions of loving-kindness meditation. Some of them simply involve chanting words, but the most powerful ones involve evoking feelings. And that's what this one is. You're evoking feelings, you're making it real. And there's a minimal amount of word chanting. So if you were to collect different Theravadin loving-kindness meditations, you'd find quite a variety. Everything from chanting the Metta Sutta to a recitation of wishes for the well-being of beings in the north and the south and the east and the west and the northeast and the southwest and so on and so forth and up and down and this down and that down. Right through to those like this one, that involve learning to activate the parts of your brain that are responsible for compassion, love, sympathetic joy. And you mentioned equanimity. Equanimity is a long-term outcome of this practice. You know, so, but when you practice sending those same wishes that you sent to somebody you love, to your worst enemy. This moves you a long way in the direction of equanimity. And admittedly, it may be hard to do at first, and that's all right. Absolutely do not blame yourself. But if you keep doing it, you'll find it easier and easier to do. And that's what's important. It's not important how difficult it is at first. It's only important that it becomes easier. Yes?
Yesterday you mentioned that peripheral awareness, if you don't have peripheral awareness up to, I think maybe you said stage six, it can really be lethal. And so Karen and I have been talking about peripheral awareness, and I think we need some more clarification on it. Maybe if you just talked about it a little bit, and then we'd see if our questions are answered. If you don't mind.
Yes, I'll redo that. She asked me to talk about peripheral awareness a little more. And I know this is probably an aspect of practice that is not too familiar to most of you. So just to begin at the beginning, if you examine conscious awareness as it normally is, you'll find that, yes, there's a focus of attention, but there's also a peripheral awareness. The two come together in greater or lesser proportions normally, all the time. And there is, it's very easy to take up a meditation practice, especially when it's given a label like concentration or something like that, and only concern yourself with the attention aspect, but not the peripheral awareness aspect. And doing so enormously amplifies the problems that you're going to encounter no matter what. No matter how skillfully you practice, when you begin, you're going to encounter dullness and you're going to encounter distraction. To the degree that you are unaware of the importance of peripheral awareness as a normal part of conscious awareness, you're going to be that much more vulnerable to dullness and distraction. When you become too closely focused on one thing, you lose peripheral awareness, you are very easily distracted and you can very easily slip into dullness. You slip into dullness because essentially you've lost a lot of stimulation of the mind. Also because in terms of the conscious activity of the mind, you're not sustaining peripheral awareness, the energy level of the mind is going down, and it's going down rapidly. And as it loses energy, then peripheral awareness suffers even more. The degree of peripheral awareness that was there when you began diminishes. And it's like, you know, if you imagine you have a spotlight with a, you know, it's bright in the middle, and it's also got a large penumbra that illuminates things. You know what happens when you turn the current down to the light? Shrinks down, and the center point, all you got left is a little, not quite so bright center point. And the next thing you know, everything goes dark. And that's what you experience in meditation if you don't sustain peripheral awareness. Likewise, if you don't sustain peripheral awareness, you're more vulnerable to distraction. Because if we look at the contents of peripheral awareness, we might divide it up into the problematic contents and the beneficial contents. The problematic contents are things like sounds and other bodily sensations, thoughts, memories, things like that, that serve as distractions. The beneficial component of peripheral awareness is that to some degree it involves being aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And that's exactly what gets lost first when peripheral awareness begins to fade. So when you forget what you're doing and why you're doing it, it's so easy for any one of those distractions to come in and take you over. So, of course, you would say, yeah, but I thought we were supposed to be becoming single-pointed. Isn't that what this is all about? And there is a point where single-pointedness is appropriate. But if you practice in a way that is single-pointed or attempts to be single-pointed, before you have developed the other mental skills that are necessary, it's never going to work. You're going to fall asleep, or you're going to find yourself, you know, in Disneyland of the mind. So there's a place for single-pointedness, but you have to work up to it. In terms of the stages of meditation, the very first place, the very first time that you want to attempt to achieve single-pointedness is in the sixth stage, when you've already completely overcome subtle distraction and, well, you've completely overcome subtle dullness, and you're in the process of overcoming subtle distraction. When overcoming subtle distraction equals becoming single-pointed. That happens in the sixth stage. To do that before only complicates the issue and makes it more difficult. The other thing with this issue of single-pointedness versus peripheral awareness is it's very easy to get the idea that the point of the practice is single-pointedness. It is only a means to an end. That's all. And it's only appropriate in a certain segment of the practice. Now, somebody that managed to get to single-pointedness and never got beyond may not know that, you know. And they may very well go and perpetuate the idea that, well, we do this practice so that we can become single-pointed. We don't. We do this practice so that we can achieve attentional stability and mindful awareness. And part of maximizing our attentional stability is to do some single-pointed practice. It's a tool along the way. And once you are capable of single-pointed practice, you are capable of the much more valuable things in addition to single-pointed practice. These include being able to follow anything that arises in your mind and follow it in specific ways. Once you've gained this degree of skill, you can watch each sensation and each thought that arises in your mind. You can watch the mind's reaction to it, what the feeling tone is that comes with that. You can see whether or not it elicits some degree of desire or aversion. And you can see as it fades away. This is the benefit of gaining that degree of attentional stability. You can, once you have this degree of skill, you can open your awareness up and you can allow anything to come and go. And instead of having your attention coalesce around one thing or another at the expense of everything else, you can stay completely open and see everything that's there. That's the benefit. Single-pointedness itself, the one thing in itself that it is conducive to, which is very valuable too, but is still something different, is the meditative absorptions, the jhanas or dhyanas. And you enter the first jhana in a state of single-pointed focus. But except for very lightest jhanas, all the subsequent levels of jhana are attained by letting go of the meditation object. You're only single-pointed in the first jhana. So you see, single-pointedness itself, it's this wonderful, useful tool. Don't get hung up on it. Don't try to get it too soon. And it's not what it's all about. It's a really useful training tool at the right stage in the process. And it helps bring your mind to a state where it has a tremendous capability to understand impermanence, the capability to understand emptiness. When your mind reaches this level of refinement, you will have experiences in meditation of impermanence, you'll have experiences of emptiness. You will find your mind, you will see exactly how your mind creates meaning out of flux. Mm-hmm. And that's where you want to go. Okay? So back to peripheral awareness. In the beginning, peripheral awareness is going to help to keep us from succumbing to dullness and distraction. And then, by deliberately intensifying our focus, the detail in which we perceive a meditation object, while at the same time not losing peripheral awareness, will increase the power of our consciousness. Because the only way that you can focus really closely on something without losing peripheral awareness is if your mind becomes more powerful, if you become more fully conscious. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Abhidhamma theory of moments of consciousness, but ordinarily we have an awful lot of potential moments of consciousness that are actually non-perceiving. When you try to focus very clearly on all the details of the breath while not losing peripheral awareness, the only way your mind can do that is to recruit a large proportion of those non-perceiving moments of consciousness and make them into actual moments of consciousness, actual perceiving moments. That's how your mind gets more powerful. So, we actually use the relationship between peripheral awareness and attention to make your mind more fully conscious. Then, as you go along, even from the very beginning, there is this aspect of peripheral awareness, which is an awareness of what's going on in the mind. In the beginning, it's pretty much known. Most of your peripheral awareness is used in the way that's most functional on the street, and knowing what's going on around you. It's an extrospective peripheral awareness. It's peripheral awareness of sensations of the body of the external world, because that's what's most useful. But there's always this component of peripheral awareness that is monitoring the mind itself. And as you go along in the practice, you cultivate that selectively. You refine that. And while you're sitting in meditation, you don't need to have peripheral awareness of body sensations and sounds and things like that. So as you go along and refine your awareness, you can give up those external objects, and those same moments of consciousness can now be employed to become more fully aware of what's going on in your own mind, the state and activity of your own mind. And so this is where peripheral awareness becomes really important. Because I mentioned jhanas. The Buddha, his first two teachers taught him the jhanas. He mastered the jhanas. And he said, nope, it's not what I'm looking for. Then after doing 5 years of austerities, he rediscovered these jhanas, and he spent the rest of his life teaching people jhana practice as a means to enlightenment. So what this tells you right away is there's something different about the jhanas that the Buddha used when he sat under the Bodhi tree, and the jhanas that he learned from Dhaka Ramaputra and Alarakalama, his teachers. And he states in the sutras very explicitly what this difference is. It's what he calls mindfulness, and it's a particular kind of mindfulness translated in English often as clear comprehension, satisampajana. It's knowing what the mind is doing, why it's doing it, and whether or not it's appropriate. When you enter jhanas as a Buddhist vipassana practice, jhanas are a vipassana practice. They're a practice that leads to insight. When you practice jhanas as a vipassana practice, you enter the jhana with very powerful introspective awareness of the state and activity of your mind. That's how you do it. That's how you follow the teaching of the Buddha. The difference, you can enter absorptions as just simply a single-pointed absorption. When the mind enters a state of absorption, a very powerful feeling of joy and happiness arises. as you refine the jhanas, it becomes more and more sublime. It makes our ordinary joy and happiness seem like something really crude. As a matter of fact, your experience progressing through the jhanas is one of getting tired of and annoyed with that, and wishing for something that is more sublime and serene. So the jhanas have that to offer, whether you have introspective awareness or not. If you train the mind sufficiently, you can enter jhanas and you can have a good old blissful time. You can go right through to the eighth, even the ninth jhana. But for it to serve as a vehicle for awakening, you must add to your jhana practice the fact that you have introspective awareness of the state and activity of the mind. And this is a very special kind of peripheral awareness. And so what I'm telling you is peripheral awareness is there before you began. And in this whole process, you're going to refine peripheral awareness and you're going to use it. And it's going to become, it is going to become an important part of what eventually brings you to those insights that lead to awakening. That was probably more of an answer than you want.
It's kind of a follow-up. Last evening when I was meditating, I was getting dull. And someone coughed behind me, jumped out of my skin. So if I was more peripherally aware, I wouldn't have had that jolt response.
That's absolutely true. Subtle dullness, one of the clues to subtle dullness is the startle reaction. If you're in meditation and a door slams, a dog barks, car horn honks, somebody coughs, and you go, you are in dullness. Because, you know, and this is something that's actually been demonstrated in the laboratory, that people who are doing the kind of meditation that results in a very high energy level of mind, very alert and awake, they in the experiments they did, you know, I hooked them up to EEGs, and they used something that made such a loud, sharp noise, it was like a pistol shot or something, you know, it was really loud. But the guys that could do this, it had no effect. It was as if they knew it was coming.
So on the peripheral awareness, if you're in your meditation and you lose the peripheral awareness, do you take a moment off of your object and go and find it again?
Yes, if you need to, definitely do that. It does, you know, yes, that's absolutely, if you realize what you've done when that happened is you recognize you're in a state of dullness. And expanding your awareness and reestablishing peripheral awareness is going to help bring you out of the dullness, and then you can refocus on your meditation object. As you go along, it won't be so necessary to abandon the meditation object. You'll just reestablish peripheral awareness. Yes? Yes. There's different kinds of preliminaries. One kind of preliminary that I think is very useful, and I know you've probably been taught some specific system of preliminaries. So I'll just speak to you in general, and you can see how it fits in with what you've learned. One way of doing preliminaries, preparing yourself for meditation, is to remind yourself of why you're doing it. Be really clear on why I'm here today, meditating. And the second thing is to be really clear on what you're going to do. Especially if you have a variety of different practices, decide in advance what you're going to do. Don't get 10 minutes into your meditation and decide, oh, well, this is not working very well today. I think I'll do such and such instead. Decide in advance and stick with it. Then, if you have a map, which is what the 10 sages are, if you have a map, you have some idea of where you are in your journey. You have some idea of the problems that you're likely to encounter and of the skills that you're in the process of refining. So, first of all, is be clear on what you expect to do in your meditation today and form a strong resolve that you're going to do your absolute best. And then the next step is to let go of all expectations. Okay, based on what's gone before, this is what kind of meditation I think I'm going to have, and I think I'm going to be working on this. But if it turns out totally different, that's all right, too. I'm going to still do the best practice I can. Then it's good to examine your mind. What's going on in your mind? What are the things that are most likely to be distractions or pose a problem in one form or another? And acknowledge those. You know, confront them. Say, okay, this is probably going to come up. When it does, I'm going to let go of it. That helps a lot. You might not think of everyone in advance, but all of the ones that you did think of are going to give you a lot of resolve that's going to help you when something that you didn't think of comes up. So this is part of a preparation for your practice. It's very powerful. And so once you've done that, you make sure your posture is good, and you're comfortable, then you can go ahead and begin to meditate. Now that's one kind of preliminary. There's another kind of preliminary that you can do that is extremely valuable. Often people, when they're just beginning to meditate, are not interested in doing this, but it involves generating a proper state of mind. You should enter your meditation in a joyful state of mind. You should be doing this definitely for your own benefit, but also for the benefit of all beings, for all the people around you, for including those people who think you should be paying attention to them right now instead of sitting here by yourself. And so, you know, you establish that in your mind, and you enter your meditation as much as possible in a state of joy. And then, before you practice, this is an excellent time to review. If you meditate once a day, you can review the previous 24 hours in terms of how mindful you were, how well you kept your precepts or vows, how well you practiced the perfections, and call to mind specific instances, both where you did and where you didn't. And you call to mind instances where you could have been more mindful. You could have acted with more patience or more compassion. And that's good. You just reflect on it without judging. It's just the way it is. It's not about scolding yourself. It's just seeing. Because by seeing, you're planting a seed so that tomorrow something similar happens. Or next month if something similar happens. Because of this review, you're more likely to be mindful. You're more likely to respond more appropriately to whatever situation has come. But also, you need to make sure that you call to mind all of your successes, all of the times when you were mindful, more mindful than you have in the past, where you practiced generosity or patience or one of the virtues, where you remembered what you're on about. Because reviewing and recollecting those is going to positively reinforce the same process. That, too, is going to make it far more likely that tomorrow or next week or next month, when similar situations arise, you are mindful and you do what's appropriate. This process of reflection can and should be a part of your practice. If there are things that you've done in the last 24 hours that are sources of worry or remorse, then you need to examine those things. You need to, are you familiar with the four powers? Practice the four powers. You can resolve, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'll do my best not to do this anymore. I might, but I'm going to do my best not to. Right? And if there's anything that you can do to make reparations for what you've done, then you make that commitment that after your meditation is over with, you're going to do that. You're going to do your best to make things right. So you need to become relatively free from the agitation of the mind that comes from worry and remorse. I don't know if you're familiar with what's called the five hindrances, but the fourth of the five hindrances is agitation due to worry and remorse. What I just described is a very powerful way of dealing with that, purifying your mind of it. And it's absolutely essential. You'll reach a certain stage in your meditation where it doesn't go any further until you've taken care of those things. So the sooner you start working on that, the more successful your meditation is going to be. The other thing that you can attend to as a part of a preliminary to your meditation is any sources of ill will that you're harboring. Because it's also the case that there's a certain stage in your meditation where, to the extent that you still have ill will, aversion, annoyance, aggravation in your heart and your mind, it is going to interfere with further progress. And so if you make it as a regular part of your preliminaries to scan your mind for any evidence. You know, it may be that you have some ill will that you didn't know about because nothing's triggered it for the last 2 years. But today, something happened. It was a phone call or whatever, and it reminded you of it, and you realize it's still there. This is the time to acknowledge it and begin the process of purifying yourself. Because that's the second of the five hindrances, these kinds of negative thoughts and attitudes. And I mentioned the five hindrances. By the way, do you know the five hindrances? No, sort of. Okay. The five hindrances are worldly desire and ill will, aversion, negativity of any kind. It's usually, the short form is ill will, but it includes every sort of negativity. And that's what I was just talking about. Okay. Then the third is, I call it resistant procrastination, resistant, sometimes it's called sloth and torpor. Those are Christian words. Yeah. Sometimes it's called laziness, things like that. But at its root, it is a resistance to practicing, or a resistance to some aspect of the practice. And so that's the third hindrance. The fourth is the agitation due to worry and remorse, which I mentioned. This comes from things that you've done. You're either worried about the consequences, or you regret the consequences. And in either case, you haven't done anything about it. And it doesn't matter whether you are consciously aware of it or not. You know, if you've been fiddling with your income taxes for the last 5 years, you may not have thought of it since last April. But that doesn't mean it's not affecting your mind today, because it is. And that would be an example of worry. What if they catch me? So the fourth hindrance is the agitation of the mind due to worry and remorse. The fifth hindrance is doubt, skeptical doubt, not healthy doubt, but skeptical doubt. These five hindrances oppose five specific meditation factors. And so, you know, they line up with certain meditation factors. The meditation factors are directed, sustained attention, joy, happiness, and single-pointedness. Equanimity is another one. But these are opposed by these hindrances. Now, what opposes single-pointedness is worldly desire. What opposes pleasure and happiness as a meditation factor, not ordinary pleasure and happiness, but there is a stage in meditation where there is, it's called pacification of the senses, physical pliancy, the body feels really good, a pleasant feeling. And then likewise, with mental pliancy, there is a feeling of happiness, a mental pleasure. So this pleasure, this mental and physical pleasure, which is a part of the meditation process, cannot arise if it is opposed by the hindrance of ill will. Instead of physical pleasure, he'll jerk and twitch and you'll feel like you've got ants crawling on your skin, or you know, cold breezes, or your hair will stand on end, and all kinds of things like that. And that's what's trying to arise is pleasure, but it can't, because it's being opposed by ill will. The agitation due to worry and remorse opposes the arising of joy, of meditative joy. And that is a very important part of the process. So if you're carrying around those sources of agitation, whether you're conscious of them or not, you're going to get to that place in your meditation and you're going to get stuck. So as preliminaries, the sooner you introduce a kind of preliminary that addresses these things, then the better prepared you're going to be when you get to those stages of meditation. But as I say, a lot of people, hey, I just came to learn to meditate. I don't need to do that other stuff. And that's fine. There will come a time when you're ready, and your teacher should, at least, will say to you, well, I think you better start working on these things, because you're getting in your way. Yes?
I'm sort of worried about talking about this, but I did a retreat for 2 days on my own, and my teacher gave me the assignment to do the four immeasurables. And I succeeded, and I did an hour and a half, and then took a break, and maybe 4 to 5 times a day, whatever I could do. Did all the preliminaries and everything. It was really boring. It was really hard. And I probably could have done more, you know, but I just never wanted to do it again. And I started like investigating whether I really meant what I was doing, or the people I was saying it to, because it's the equanimity and the happiness and longing for no suffering. And just like how many years, how many eons?
let me talk about that.
I wanted to succeed, but I have to, I mean, I'm putting out a can of worms. So
No. This is a good thing you agree. I'll tell you about my own experience. I was taught preliminaries as a formula. I'm one of these people who talk about that, and I didn't see any point in this. I tried it. It was boring. It was tedious. It seemed stupid. It seemed useless. It was a formula. I sit there and recite this formulaic thing. So, I didn't do it. And then I got to the stage of my meditation when I learned what it was really for. And I learned that it's not a formula. And it's too bad that it's taught that way. It has to come from the heart. It has to be sincere. It's a process of genuine, deep reflection. Soul-searching, if you will. And soul-searching that leads to making changes in what's happening in your mind. The things that I talked about, they have to make changes. You know, you can't just verbally confess to yourself that, oh, I did this and I did that. That's not going to do any good. You have to, deep in your heart, want to change. You want to change enough that if there's somebody that you can call, or something you can do, if there's something you can return, if there's something that you're willing to do, then your preliminaries, totally different thing. They're really powerful. So. And it's the same thing with the practice you mentioned. The Brahma Viharas is what they're called, and you called them the four immeasurables. But very often, way too often, you will be taught those practice as a formula, as a boring, tedious recitation. And that's not really what it's about. You know? So if you get to the heart of what it is, you'll find it's both the preliminaries and the practice of the immeasurables are something much, much more powerful, meaningful, actually much easier to do. I hope that helps. Yes? Yeah.
So is it much more powerful if you just stop beating yourself up?
Yeah, that actually, you know, that's almost the very first thing you should do, is stop beating yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the more you beat yourself up, the more you're reinforcing the sources of the problem. It's to change yourself or to change the world, either one. The first step is to accept the way it is. You have to accept the way it is before you are sufficiently empowered to really make changes. And so quit beating yourself up. Yeah. There must be more questions. There are.
So as part of the preliminaries that we do, is we bring our guru, our lama, or our holy being to join us. And I personally find that very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So is that part of the preliminaries that we should do?
That's part of preliminaries if you do guru yoga, yeah. Not everyone does guru yoga. Yes.
So what are your feelings about guru yoga?
That's a big question. A thorny issue. I've never practiced it and I've never missed it. I've seen other people practicing it, and in my opinion, it's problematic. I don't think Westerners understand guru yoga the same way that Indians and Tibetans do. So, I suspect most of you in this room are practicing guru yoga. May it serve you well. Yes?
I think that Westerners probably can practice guru yoga. They just have to replace whatever it is that they're using right now. What they should.
Yeah. There are, yeah, I think, you know, we really do come from very different cultures. And That's where the problem is. So to practice a kind of yoga that is based on a very different cultural attitude, to do that effectively, there needs to be kind of a fundamental shift in the way you look at things. You know, I talking the other day to somebody, yesterday I guess, that a Tibetan Rinpoche describes how he and other students in the Tibetan monastery used to play tricks on their guru by doing things like tying their shoelaces together.
until an American can understand that, you're going to be impaired in your ability to practice guru yoga.
Can you take that a little further?
I'm getting out of my field here. You know, I'm a specialist. As I say, I've never practiced guru yoga.
I was just going to ask to take it further. My observation was that it's a more flexible relationship than we might think.
Exactly. Okay. Much more flexible. Mm-hmm. And much more realistic. I think the tendency of North Americans is to see guru yoga in much more unrealistic terms than it's intended. I'll talk about something that's completely different, but it may give you an idea of these kinds of cultural differences. In Burma, people tend to be really relaxed. I don't know, it's a hot country, I guess, whatever the reason. The culture there is one that nobody does more than they have to. You just simply don't exert yourself more than you absolutely have to. And it's universal. It's the attitude. Only a fool would exert themselves more than they have to. You assess the situation and you do what you've got to do, and enough's enough. So in a Burmese monastery, the teachers are always admonishing the monks and the lay people that come to practice to work harder and to try harder and to be more diligent. But then, in the 60s and 70s, they had a bunch of Americans that went to Burma and went into these monasteries. And they would say, work harder and try harder and strive more diligently. And these people started having nervous breakdowns. Because in our culture, it's different. They were already willing to probably work harder than most of the Burmese monks. And so they didn't need somebody saying. So it's those kinds of differences. So it's a completely different thing. But it illustrates cultural differences, attitudinal differences, that sometimes, you know, taking something from another culture, it doesn't fit quite the way we would hope that it would.
On that note, I was wondering about, do you feel the importance of a teacher? I mean, in guru yoga, we have practices that most people know about here, but then there's the importance of taking yourself to a teacher.
Of taking
yourself to a teacher.
Yeah.
Possibly
different than guru yoga, or if it is different.
Or not.
Well, what do you think? Is it different than guru yoga? If you wanted to learn calligraphy, you'd probably look for a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of teacher would you look for?
Skilled calligrapher.
What's that?
A very skilled calligrapher.
Yeah, somebody who is skilled in calligraphy. And if there happens to be four calligraphy teachers in your town, what criteria would you use to decide which one that you would follow as a teacher? You'd look at their calligraphy,
yeah.
But they probably all look pretty good to you because you're not a calligrapher. So that might help, might rule out one of the four or something. I don't like this style. But what other things would you look for? Yeah, right. You'd probably go and talk to them.
Yeah.
Talk to them all and see how you felt. What else? What if they had other students?
Oh, you should check out their other students.
Talk to their other students. And maybe look at their students' calligraphy. Yeah. Right? Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's probably more valuable than how well you feel you get along. Look at the other students' calligraphy. Because that's going to give you a better idea of what you're going to get. So, you know, there's not a mystery in this. Apart from guru yoga, you want the best teacher you can find, you want somebody you can work with and feel comfortable, because no matter how good they are, if the two of you don't match up, you're not going to benefit. But you want a teacher that knows how to teach. And they have to have something to teach, they have to be master of what it is they're teaching. But they also have the ability to successfully transmit that to someone else. And so all of these things are factors. So just in terms of a teacher, those are the kind of things that you want. Same thing's true meditation, you know. Or Dharma.
About the breath as your preferred meditation focus because it's spontaneously arising. It's a spontaneously arising phenomenon. But so are my thoughts. So, or at least they seem so. So why the breath?
Your thoughts are mental fabrications. In the beginning, your breath might be a mental fabrication too. But eventually, it will cease being a mental fabrication, and you'll be dealing with present moment reality in its natural form. That's one reason. Another reason is that the whole purpose of a meditation object, it's just a tool. It's just something to anchor your attention on. And so the qualities that it has that will make it most suitable for that, you know, that's how you should evaluate potential meditation objects. You can do meditation on your thoughts. That is a kind of meditation. But realistically, it's not the easiest meditation object. And it's better for many people, until they develop considerable skill, they just simply, you know, they just, all they would do is get lost in their thoughts.
For some of us who've been studying in this lineage, a spontaneously arising is an image of our guru, Karen was talking about. And so I can't tell for myself in the last couple of days if I've been struggling against the breath because I think I mentioned to you the breath gets a bad rap in our lineage a little bit as a meditation object. Or, you know, but also the image of the guru does get heightened for us. And so I can't tell if my struggling against the breath is just a mental affliction or if it's, you know, if it's a deeply rooted issue of faith.
It's most likely just a habit of mind. You're used to one thing and switching to something different, especially if you've been told things. As you say, it gets a bad rap. My sense is it probably gets a bad rap because most of the time it hasn't actually been the sensations of the breath they're talking about. It's been some kind of visualization of the breath. Well, if you're going to visualize something, yeah, you're better off visualizing a sacred image than you are visualizing the breath. I agree with that totally. But then that's not a fair comparison. The sensations of the breath are something completely different than a visualization of the breath. And the benefits and attributes they offer are different. I think mostly what you're experiencing is a combination of being used to visualization of an object and some hesitation and worry because you've been told things. Now, comparing these two, if you're just beginning to meditate, you're going to... there is a real advantage to using the breath. You're going to... you have one whole thing that you don't need to master at this early stage, which is the generating of the visualization. You can get right to the nitty-gritty of cultivating mindful awareness and attentional stability. That's the advantage. Once you have achieved a certain degree of that, if you wanted to switch to a visualization of an image, it's going to be a piece of cake, because your mind's already been trained. So if you were just beginning, I would really recommend you use the breath. If you've already been visualizing an image for 5 years, and you can do so successfully, hey, no problem. Use the visualized image. You've already done all of that work. There are still some advantages of the breath sensations over a visualized image. When you get to the fifth and the sixth stages, particularly, there are techniques you can use with the breath that you just can't use with a visualized image. But there are other ways to master those stages. So, ultimately, almost anything can serve as a meditation object. But some things have certain advantages, and sometimes those advantages and disadvantages are on an entirely individual level. Yeah?
Yeah. My first introduction to meditation was, practicing Vipassana in a center, and, and then later coming to this tradition and lineage, and I'm listening to some of the questions and it is interesting. I'm not sure I really have a handle completely that I can express in a comprehensible way. But a couple things. One is, earlier when you said about guru yoga not working in the West, I was raised a Catholic. And I studied here for some time and then went back to, church services with family members. And between reading the gospel and listening to the priest give a homily, I'm like, oh my God, they're teaching karma and emptiness. And it was right there. And then I reflected more on, in particular, my mother and my grandmother and their special devotion to the Blessed Mother and the saints. And reflecting further, what I realized is if I hadn't had the experience of being a student of the Vipassana, tradition, and learning how to, cultivate stillness and try to master my mind a little bit, I may not have been able to get to the point where I could sit and do some of the meditations that I've been taught here that in some respects are maybe more like prayer than meditation, certain kinds. But not to suggest that I was ever an advanced student of Vipassana, but I think what I did need and I found here was a very explicit moral focus or ethical focus. And so that that I need to focus on the breath. I still focus on the breath to quiet my mind and prepare myself for meditations that I do in this tradition. But having a virtuous object has served me well. But the other piece about the guru yoga that I think does work for people in this part of the world.
I didn't say it didn't work. I said it was problematic.
I can see why it's problematic. I think it's problematic if people aren't studying with teachers able to transmit effectively or provide the opportunity to understand karma and emptiness, number one. Like, where's that teacher coming from? But just seeing how my mother, my grandmother, and others would use these spiritual guides, okay, to help them, and see how the availability, having, you know, seeing that all that's available to you to then, you know, bring that forth and change the world that you see. So, but I do think it is, it's tricky. It's like, on the one hand, you, it, based on the what I've received this weekend and what I've received for years coming here, is that I really need to do a variety of meditation practices. And it's almost like the Vipassana is a technique. And a lot of the other meditations that we do are more almost like prayer and exploration and analyzing.
Yes, you do a lot of analytical
meditations, right.
You are not the first to notice the similarities between Catholicism and Tibetan Buddhism. It comes up actually quite frequently. And what's funny is it's often people who abandon the Catholic Church with a lot of frustration and disappointment and things like that, and now find that, now realize that there's a lot of similarities there and a lot of value. It's interesting, a fallen away Catholic can often understand Catholicism better because they spent some time studying Tibetan Buddhism. So, but it's true, a lot of similarities. Yeah.
Could you say something about the concept of Satori in Zen, which was, I don't know the exact definition, but it was like a sudden awakening rather than a long process?
Well, first of all, I don't want to say too much about Zen because it's not something that I have a lot of expertise in. But there is this gradual awakening versus sudden awakening debate that's gone on for a very long time. And when I've looked into it, it evaporates. And Zen Satori is an example. A Zen practitioner has a Satori, and then they have a whole lot of work to do. So, you know, quite honestly, what is the difference? Yeah. Yeah.
What's helped me this weekend with connecting with the breath is, one, it brought a wholeness to the body and the mind. So if I'm visualizing or doing other kinds of meditation, I wasn't aware of how disconnected I was from my body and from my breathing. And of course we start life with the first breath, and we end this lifetime with the last breath. And so for me, I can see how I personally need this basis, and how that then can serve. It's like if I'm disconnecting from the body, whatever meditation I'm doing isn't really whole, because we're one. It's like we're body mind. We're not in our society, in the Christian tradition too. There was a separation between the body and the mind, and I think that was a problem. So I really appreciate what you've offered here. So. And I appreciate the teacher within.
Thank
you very much for being this weekend. I practiced in the Zen tradition for a good number of years, and then in the Vipassana tradition for a small number of years, and now here, so sort of covering the waterfront. But just a comment on the Satori thing. You're absolutely right. Satori is like turning on a light in a completely darkened room. And you see the amount of furniture that has to be moved around to make it functional. And there are sartoric events, if that's a word, that in Vipassana, and also in this tradition, where you get to a certain level, it's like, oh, that's what I have to do. I've been going down this different road. So that I think the concept of satori is very, very useful in the three traditions that I've been involved in, just slightly differently applied.
Yeah, you know, so often I find that things that seem to be different, when you examine them closely, they're not.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, if, to the degree that they're talking about truth. You know, they've got to converge. Well, we're 10 minutes past the official stopping time, so I look forward to seeing you this evening if you can come back, and we'll continue this discussion.
Thank you.